Hi, I'm Deborah Lynn Dadd, and this is Toxic Free Talk Radio, where we talk about how to thrive in a toxic world and live toxic free. Today is Tuesday, May 20th, 2014. I'm here in Clearwater, Florida on a beautiful early summer day. And my guest today is toxicologist Dr. Stephen Gilbert, PhD, DABT, who he's been on the show so many times. I actually, if you go to toxicfreetalkradio.com, underneath today's description of the show, I actually put links to all of his shows. And he's been on seven times. One, two, three, four, five, six. No, he's been on six times. This is show number seven he's been on. I think that he is the most frequent guest on this show, but I think one of the most important because he talks with us about why toxic chemicals are toxic and where they are and what they do to our bodies and why we need to be concerned about them. And this is the information that we all need to have about what are the chemicals that we need to be watching out for. He is the director and founder of the Institute for Neurotoxicology and author of A Small Dose of Toxicology, The Health Effects of Common Chemicals, which is, I think, a book that every single person needs to have. It's free. You can go to his website and download it. It's easy to read, and it tells you all the basics of toxicology and the basic toxic chemicals that we need to be concerned about. So his website is toxipedia.org, T-O-X-I-P-E-D-I-A.org. And you can go there and download A Small Dose of Toxicology. And I'm going to remind you of this all throughout the show because I think it's so important for you to get this book. And especially, it's free. It's free. Just go download it and start learning this stuff. It's important because everything, all these things are toxic in our world. Hi, Dr. Gilbert.
Hi, Deborah. Nice to hear you this morning.
Thank you. I didn't realize
you'd been on the show that many times.
I didn't either until I counted them up.
That's great.
So you get the award for most frequent guest. And I hope many more. We will never run out of things to talk about.
There really isn't. Toxicology is a broad field. There's lots to talk about.
There is. So today we're going to talk about endocrine disruptors. So would you start out by explaining what our endocrine system is? I know that one of the things I discovered a few years ago when I was writing my most recent book, Toxic Free, is that I realized that toxic chemicals now are known to affect every body system. And as I was writing about that, I realized that I didn't really know what my body systems were. And not only could I not list them, I really didn't know what was involved in each one of them. And the endocrine system really is one of the most complex and one of the most, well, all of our body systems are essential, but the endocrine system is responsible for a lot of our everyday activities that we would not like to be without. So tell us what the endocrine system does.
Yeah, you're really right. The endocrine system is very complex, and it's responsible for very low doses of chemicals. And you can think of our blood system as distributing the endocrine chemicals. So our blood supply distributes these chemicals out that are produced by different glands in our body. For example, ovaries in the female produce progesterone and estrogen, which are incredibly important for pregnancy and have a range of effects on growth and sexual characteristics. The same with testosterone, which is produced by the testes in the male, responsible for muscle mass, bone density, and sexual maturation. So those are just two examples. Another good one is that people probably heard of is insulin, produced by the pancreas, very important for regulating glucose. And we have a number of other glands, you know, from adrenal glands, thyroid, pituitary, pineal gland, are just a few of the other ones that are really incredibly important in the endocrine system. Now, the challenge is when we disrupt that system, that's what we're going to talk about with endocrine disruptors.
Right. And so I want to make sure that we say that the types of disorders that are associated, that when these glands are disrupted, then you end up with things like, well, if you can't regulate the insulin, then that's diabetes. If your reproductive hormones are messed up, well, that's need to go to the doctor for Viagra. It also regulates weight. And so we have this tremendous epidemic of obesity in this country. Well, that's endocrine system. And all these different things that that are everyday things that we're dealing with. there's so much of it is the endocrine system. So, go ahead.
I was going to say it's very important during development. Is that we as we mature, we develop sexual characteristics, and that's where a lot of important cell types and development is laid down, from fetal development on up through puberty. So it's very important during that period of time and cause neurological disorders as well as, like you mentioned, weight gain or diabetes. So it really lays a framework for and foundation for future disorders in our body, including cancer.
Now, I've been working on this subject for, not the subject of endocrine disruptors, but the subject of toxic chemicals. I've been researching for more than 30 years. And I remember when I started, there wasn't a lot of information, and my first awareness was how toxic chemicals affected the immune system, because that's what it looked like was going on in my body. But so in 1993, we didn't even know about endocrine disruptors until 1993. And I remember when people first started talking about them, I could see that not only was my immune system messed up, but my endocrine system was messed up, because everything that was wrong with my body was all related to the endocrine system, every single thing. And I went, oh my God, this is it. It's endocrine disruption. And so I know this one firsthand. So tell us about what happened in 1993 that made everybody aware of endocrine disruptors.
Well, there's a couple really important events that occurred both the 90s and even before that. And I just want to step back before that a little bit. We learned a lot about endocrine disruptors when we tried to produce hormonal contraceptives. And they were produced some of the research started in the 30s. And in 1939, Russell Marker developed synthetic progesterones. It was in 1960, May 9th, 1960, the Food and Drug Administration recognized the pill. And this is really, in some ways, the most exquisite endocrine disruptor, because it disrupts female fertility. It's had enormous impact on our lives.
What kind of things have happened to women who took the pill? I never took the pill.
That's a good question. Because when they first started using these endocrine disruptors, estrogen and progesterone combination, they used relatively high doses, which caused blood clots in the lungs and legs of women, or some women, taking these things, and particularly for women that smoked. And this they then lowered, and they found they could really lower the amount of estrogen and progesterone used in the pill to very small levels, because the endocrine system is so exquisitely sensitive.
Did those women go on, I mean, after they started taking the lower dose even, did those women go on to have health effects because their endocrine systems were now unbalanced?
You could say that. They're sort of unbalanced, a little bit too much stimulation. And I don't think they ever really figured out why it caused embolism and blood clots for the, disrupting endocrine system. It's just one of the many side effects. So the endocrine system is very sensitive to chemicals.
Yes.
Men use and athletes use array of hormones and hormone supplements to boost muscle mass. And testosterone is one thing, artificial and synthetic testosterone is used in sports events and sports enhancement.
There's a really wonderful book called Our Stolen Future. And so if anybody listening wants to know more about endocrine disruptors, that was the first book that I was aware of that came out about it and is still a really good book. And we're going to go to the break pretty soon, but when we come back, we're going to talk more about endocrine disruptors and the chemicals that harm the endocrine system. And what's really important about this is that it used to be that the dose made the poison. So some poisons were not poisonous until you got up to high doses. But endocrine disruptors affect your body at very, very low doses that we're being exposed to on a daily basis. So we'll talk about more about that when we come back. This is Toxic Free Talk Radio. Thank you. This is Toxic Free Talk Radio. I'm Deborah Lynn Dadd, and my guest today is Dr. Stephen Gilbert, author of A Small Dose of Toxicology. And during the break, you could rush over to his website and download it at toxipedia.org. We'll be right back. Talk Radio. I'm Deborah Lynn Dadd, and my guest today is Dr. Stephen Gilbert, author of A Small Dose of Toxicology. Again, I'll tell you, it's free, and you can go to his website, toxipedia.org, and download it. It's got so much information, including a lot of what we're talking about today. So I'm looking at your website, which has so much information on it, and I'm on a page about endocrine disruptors, and I see this little ad from the past about DES.
Oh, right.
You want to tell us about DES?
Yes. DES is a really important story in understanding endocrine disruptors. DES is diacetylstilbestrol. And I want to also mention another sort of a sister compound to DES is BPA, bisphenol A, which was actually first created in 1891. So it's a long history with this. It was recognized as a very low-level endocrine compound. But DES was synthesized in 1938. And it was recognized as a very potent endocrine disruptor and estrogen mimic, so synthetic estrogen. And this is used to treat miscarriages, the threat of miscarriage, and for postmenopausal women. So the problem was, though, that it was approved by the FDA in 1947 to prevent miscarriages. And there was the first study in 1953. And I want to emphasize that it was approved in 47. In 53 were the first studies that said it was not effective for preventing miscarriages. And this was consumed. So it was regularly prescribed, though doctors thought it was a good thing to continue to prescribe. It was not until 1971 when the first study was published showing that offspring of women that consumed DES had a rare form of vaginal cancer. So this is sort of a second generation effect of DES. And this then, DES withdrawn, but during that period, millions of young women had been exposed to DES, had an increased risk for vaginal cancers. So it was really a wake-up call to very low-level exposure to an estrogen mimic, that synthetic estrogen, could cause serious problems for offspring of women that consumed it. And this was really sort of a sea change in toxicology, recognizing that possibility. And along with that was a very low-level effect of these compounds, very small amounts can cause effects, which is sort of goes against some of toxicology's principle of dose response. The greater the dose, the greater response. And some of these estrogen disruptors, very low level of exposure, really sort of a U-shaped curve showing that very low level of exposure, there's effects that they sort of taper off, and then there's different effects at higher doses. So DES is a really, really interesting example of cross-generational effects of a compound.
Wow. So it's so interesting to me that that these things can, what we're being exposed to today, like when I was born in 1955. I know I don't sound that old, but I was born in 1955. And at that time, nobody was even thinking about these things. Yet, after reading Silent Spring by Rachel Carson, I realized that when I was born, my mother was already exposed to toxic chemicals and that I was exposed in the womb. And that's even more of a concern today because we have so many more chemicals than we did in 1955. But it's so babies, I mean, even before babies are born, the DNA has already been, or even before they're conceived, the DNA has already been changed.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think the thing that's really concerning about endocrine disrupting chemicals is we're exposed to a broad array of chemicals that are endocrine disruptors. So it's not just one compound that's an endocrine disruptor. For example, bisphenol A, about 90% of us excrete BPA, bisphenol A, in our urine. So we're constantly exposed to it from cash registers, receipts, tin can lining, from plastics, from just a huge array of products. Phthalates is another one that causes endocrine disruptors. And that's, we're exposed to many forms of phthalates in fragrances and perfumes and personal care products. So flame retardants, you just go down the list of chemicals a lot of the pesticides are in it, constructors. So we're exposed to really array of these things. It starts really preconception for the woman and goes, and for the man too, because they do cause disruption in sperm. Well, sperm counts have been linked to endocrine disruptors. So it's just a wide, wide array from preconception on to neurodevelopment and then postnatally.
I recently heard over the weekend that, and I'm looking for the reference for this, I'm sure I'll find one, that the Human Genome Project found that we're not so much the product of our genes, but the product of our environment. I don't have the number right in front of me, but it's something like very small, less than 10% of what happens in our bodies is by our genes, and that the genes can be affected by the environment. They are being affected by the environment. And when I when I heard that, I thought, well, if they're affected by the environment, then what we're giving our genes are toxic chemicals, which are changing their character. I also read that nutrition, good nutrition, will improve your genes, and that it can actually improve your DNA. And so do we want to be giving those basic building blocks of our bodies, do we want to be giving them toxic chemicals, or do we want to be giving them something good, like good nutrition?
Yeah, you raise a really good point. I think, having good nutrition is really critical, using organic compounds as much as possible that have fewer pesticides and pesticide contaminants is really important. And you're really touching on the issue of epigenetics, where we're really changing the expression of DNA by exposure to these chemicals, and that gets into our environment, with more stress the environment, and it changes the endocrine system in a way, because the flight or fight response is part of that system. So stress increases cortisol levels, which changes the endocrine responses. So it's a very complex, interrelated system that we continue to fiddle with and contaminate with chemicals, as well as our stressful environment that we have.
It's just, sometimes I wonder, how do we stay alive? I mean, that just goes to, shows the resilience of our bodies. But, not everybody, I really know that for myself, that I have been having to address body conditions all my life that have to do with chemical exposures. And it's not that I'm being exposed to these chemicals anymore, but that damage was caused to my body at a time early on. And then I still, my health has improved tremendously, but still there's things going on. Anyway, we need to go to break. This is Toxic Free Talk Radio. I'm Deborah Lynn Dadd, and my guest today is Dr. Stephen Gilbert. Go to toxopedia.org and download his book, A Small Dose of Toxicology. We'll be right back. You're listening to Toxic Free Talk Radio. I'm Deborah Lynn Dadd, and my guest today is Dr. Stephen Gilbert. He's the author of A Small Dose of Toxicology, which you can download for free at toxopedia.org, full of great information. So, Dr. Gilbert, I'm looking at your list of potential endocrine disruptors, and you've mentioned some of them, but I'd just like us to go over the list as a whole here, because I can see some of these. I'm thinking from the viewpoint of how do we get these out of our bodies? And I know that bisphenol A, I've studied that quite a bit about detox, and what I've learned is most people have an ongoing presence of bisphenol A in their bodies, not because it's persistent in the body, but because we continue to be exposed to it. But if we stop being exposed to it, some studies have shown that within a few days, it'll just clear itself out of the body, that the body will detox itself. So it's not a matter of needing to take something specific for it. But I'm looking at this list, and the first one on the list is DDT, which you note is no longer allowed in the U.S., but it's been many, many years since it's been banned. And it still is. Wasn't this the pesticide that Rachel Carson wrote about in Silent Spring? Was DDT?
Yes, that's right. She wrote about DDT. And it's still
ubiquitous, isn't it?
Yes, it's still ubiquitous. We're still exposed to it from, animals that we consume And it's a very persistent chemical. And we've tried to get rid of some of these persistent bioaccumulative chemicals, but DDT is a classic example of one that just continues to survive in the food chain. And it's also still being used in mosquito nets in some places in developing countries to fight mosquitoes. It's a very effective pesticide, but it had this very bad side effect of just staying around, and it continues to be present in people's bodies and is now known to be an endocrine disruptor. And it's very difficult to get rid of because it is stored in the fat. And one way that a woman reduces her body burden of DDTs is doing breastfeeding, because they immobilize a lot of fat during that period. They immobilize some of the DDT, which exposes the developing infant to DDT and other endocrine disrupting compounds.
Wow. I mean, it's just the more I learn about toxic chemicals, but I've been learning about them for so long. But still, the more I learn about toxic chemicals, the more it just seems like such a bad idea that this even happened in the first place.
We just have not been thoughtful.
Yeah.
We just haven't been thinking more carefully about future generations and really guarding our children, because we really want our children to be able to reach and maintain their full potential. And they can't do that when they're exposed to this wide array of chemicals.
No. Some other things on this list. I mean, this is just the list of the big bad chemicals that I've been hearing about in the news all my life. DDT, 2,4-D, PCB, DES, and more recently PBDE, polybrominated diphenyl ethers. That's the one that's in the fire retardant.
Right.
Phthalates in plastics, bisphenol A, dioxin. Arsenic. Dr. Gilbert has this chart here, and it says arsenic, lead, and mercury, widespread contaminants. All the other ones he's talking about, you know, 2,4-D is an herbicide, atrazine is an herbicide, BPA is a hardener in plastics, and then he gets down to arsenic, lead, and mercury, and it says widespread contaminants. And these are widespread, and we're looking at all this, and it's like our poor endocrine systems.
It's very serious, our lack of, you know, really trying to pay attention to chemical exposure. Like mercury is in coal. So you burn coal-fired utility plants, you distribute mercury throughout the environment. And that's a really serious consideration, particularly on the West Coast, because we get all the air coming from China. So these are global issues. It's not just an issue in the United States. These are global issues. We've tried to corral bisphenol A, for example, in children's products. We banned bisphenol A in baby toys and try to get it out of plastic bottles and things like that. But you know, why do we start off putting them in there without studying the potential health effects? Phthalates are in personal care products and used in fragrances. You know, so we end up being exposed to these products from multiple sources. They're in our cars. They're in the plastics. They're in phthalates from shower curtains, a plastic shower curtain, will have phthalates that'll off gas from that product. So it really is, you know, not being thoughtful about chemical exposures. And we put the burden on individuals to try to corral this work, where we really should have a more broad effort to manage our chemicals. Because if we put new drugs into the environment, we have a very precautionary approach where the Food and Drug Administration is required to study the potential toxicity as well as the benefits of the compound. We do not have a similar approach when putting industrial chemicals into the environment, exposing our children.
Last night I was watching TV and I wasn't awake enough to remember exactly all of what I'm about to tell you, but there was a commercial on for a drug, and we're all familiar with those drug commercials where they give you a beautiful picture and some nice music and a nice pleasant voice saying about all the side effects, and but last night it just went on and on and on and on, and it ended with death and as being a side effect. But the thing that really impressed me was that it was a drug for something that had nothing to do with saving your life or being comfortable. It was like some cosmetic thing, like makes your eyelashes grow longer or something like that. And it just amazes me that all of these health effects can be known, and yet they're still allowed to be sold, and that, you know, every night we're watching TV and there's at least one or two or three drug commercials that are talking about the dangers of these drugs, and yet they're being sold, they're being advertised, and people buy them. And so do you have any comment on the fact that we could be having all these warnings and yet people aren't listening?
Well, I think we're just overwhelmed with that kind of information sometimes. You know, we get lots of information, and we want to do things too quickly sometimes and want a quick fix. And I think our whole medical profession has been geared toward the cure instead of preventing disease. So yes. We look for a quick fix to prevent, you know, whatever disease we have. And a lot of these are for cure whatever disease we have or fix it. And we're not looking at the longer-term issue of preventing disease, like having good nutrition, you know, having fewer chemical exposures, where we're trying to prevent obesity, trying to prevent diabetes, trying to prevent endocrine disruptive effects on the nervous system, ADHD, hyperactivity. So we need to be, and autism, for example, we need to be working right. to prevent these and not just try to fix them post hoc. But the money is made by treating disease, not preventing disease. And that's something that's, you know, sort of a systemic problem in our medical system, where the whole medical pharmaceutical industry has been geared toward treating disease, not preventing disease.
I think what's really important
about your show is that you're trying to focus people on how to prevent illnesses and try to get in front of this instead of working from behind all the time.
Thank you. We need to go to break, but we can talk about that more when we come back. My guest today, you're listening to Toxic Free Talk Radio. I'm Deborah Lynn Dadd, and my guest today is Dr. Stephen Gilbert, author of A Small Dose of Toxicology. And I really need to go before the commercial comes on. You're listening to Toxic Free Talk Radio. I'm Deborah Lynn Dadd, and my guest today is toxicologist Dr. Stephen Gilbert, author of A Small Dose of Toxicology, and you can get this book for free from toxipedia.org, and it's well worth downloading it and taking a look, because it'll help you understand what's going on in the world with toxic chemicals a lot better. So, Dr. Gilbert, this is our last segment now. We're going to run out of time soon. So is there anything that you'd like to talk about that I haven't asked you yet?
Just a quick mention. You know, my website, if you go to the book, you can download the chapter on endocrine disruptors as well as a PowerPoint presentation about it, just to give a quick overview of the health effects of endocrine disruptors. And I want to point out another really good, if you want to dig into more details, the Endocrine Disruptor Exchange, TEDx. You can get there by endocrinedisruption.org. It gives a lot more details about health effects of endocrine disruptors, as well as sort of more details on the endocrine system. It also explores chemicals and natural gas operations and fracking, and has another section on pesticides. And another resource that's really come out recently is a new book by Philip Grandjean, and his website called chemicalbraindrain.info.
Ooh.
And you can get his new book from there. So that's chemicalbraindrain.info, and he explores some of the endocrine disruptors as well as other chemicals and effects on early development. But I think what we're really emphasizing here with endocrine disruption is the exquisite sensitivity of the developing nervous system, developing body, and that we need to be thinking more about that. And the other thing that's important is that everything is not just straight dose response. It's not the more of a compound, the more the effect. It's also these very low-level, subtle changes in performance and subtle long-term effects, and effects that we garner in our early life can really have impact as we grow older. And DES is just one example of that, but it can also be increased incidence of diabetes, other nervous system disorders, as well as sexual dysfunction, and low sperm counts, other deformities. So it really is a very complex system that we're perturbing in unknown ways.
And the best thing that we can do is to be aware of where those chemicals are, what the chemicals are, where those chemicals are, what the alternatives are, so that we can create a toxic-free home
More broadly, we need chemical policy reform. It really does get at the heart of the matter. We have more information about chemicals we put into the products we use.
We need to have better labeling.
Much better labeling, much more transparency about what chemicals are in the products and what the potential health effects of these products are, and really move toward an environment that uses fewer chemicals.
I think we need to, one of the reasons why I like doing this radio show is because we just need to have more awareness so that people can say, oh, I understand that there's a problem and what can we do about it? Because I know that I'm constantly talking to people that they don't even know that there's a problem at all. And these are intelligent people and they're just not aware of it. As much as people talk about it, it's still not like part of our collective awareness and that we all together should be doing this and that this is the right thing.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think we sort of assume that, you know, it's out in the product and the government must take a look at it. And often the case that the government has not taken a good look at it and is not really monitoring the chemical exposures. And the thing to really emphasize is we're not exposed to just one endocrine disruptor. We're exposed to a lot of them. They have similar mechanisms of action. And we do our assessment of these chemicals one chemical at a time. It's very difficult to do mixtures of chemicals that we're in reality exposed to.
But we even if they did that in the lab, they can't possibly duplicate what mixture of chemicals I'm being exposed to because
right.
It's different than the mixture of chemicals you're being exposed to. And each of our listeners has their own, I'm trying to figure out what is the right word here, minefield of chemicals that they are, that's what it is. It's like walking through a minefield. As you move through
your
day.
Yeah, we have an individual sensitivity is really important, knowing what we're exposed to and what our responses, our individual responses, because we all metabolize chemicals a little bit differently. The chemicals we're exposed to influences our genetic response to these chemicals we're exposed to. So it's a very complex environment that we land in, and we're all individuals, and we do not pay enough attention to individual sensitivity. For example, kids are much more sensitive than adults, and we don't account for that in our assessment of the toxicity response to these chemicals.
Well, I don't want this to sound really scary. I mean, it is. It actually is something scary that we should be concerned enough about it. We should be scared enough to do something. But I don't want people to feel so scared that they think that it's that there's nothing that they can do. And I know in my own personal experience that being aware of the toxic chemicals in my environment, whether it's in my home or as I'm out in the world, and knowing what I can do to help protect my body has so greatly increased my health. It's just astounding to me. So even though my health isn't perfect, because there's been damage done to my body even before I became aware of it, I am so much more functional than I have been at other times in my life when I was being exposed to toxic chemicals. And I just want to emphasize that it's so worth it. It's so worth it to do whatever you can do to find out where the toxic chemicals are that you're being exposed to, whether they're endocrine disruptors or they harm your immune system or whatever it is that they do. If they're toxic, you want to stay away from them. And when you do that, and if you do things to start removing toxic chemicals from your body, you will see a difference. You will see a difference. I am willing to say I can guarantee you will see a difference because we're exposed to so many toxic chemicals that if we just do something, it's going to reduce that stress on our bodies and our health can return.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Deborah. I think reducing the chemicals use in our homes, in our schools, is really important in just being more conscious of those issues and what chemicals might be in the products we use and try to reduce exposure to them. Take off your shoes when you come in the house. Wash your hands. You know, I have a couple grandchildren. The first thing you do when they come in the house, take off your shoes. Before you eat, you have to wash your hands. So simple things like that are really important, too, in trying to reduce exposure to chemicals because chemicals are in so many different places. You know, when we touch an old seat cushion, we pick up bromine flame retardants on our fingers. So it's very important to just try to be aware of where the chemical exposures might be coming from and little simple things to help reduce exposures.
I I totally agree with you. And even if you are only doing some small baby steps, it's worth it to do those. You don't have to, don't think that just because you're not doing everything that what you're doing right. isn't making a difference, because it does. Every little bit helps. Every little bit helps. And, you know, I have a very non-toxic house. I know a lot of stuff. I don't know everything there is to know, but I've been doing this for more than 30 years. So I started out knowing nothing. I started out having as toxic a life as anybody could have. And I wore perfume, drank tap water. I ate TV dinners. I grew up on TV dinners. So I probably had as much chemical exposure as anybody has ever had. I remember, you know how smells, I think I read somewhere that some of our strongest memories are about smells. And mm-hmm. I think about like smells from my childhood, and I'll tell you, I want to tell you three of them that come to mind immediately. One is the smell of my mother's ballpoint pen, the ink in my mother's ballpoint pen. She always wrote with pink ballpoint pens, and I remember that smell. And then I learned what was in ballpoint pen ink. Okay. So then another one was, my grandmother's sofa. And, the third one was, my grandfather, the garage was his space. And so the smell of his garage was gasoline, because he just had cans and cans of gasoline. And as a little kid, I was just there in just smelling the gasoline. And, you know, nobody even thought twice about it. Nobody had an awareness when I was a kid that we should even be thinking about toxics. But now we know. Now we know, and we should do something about it.
You're absolutely right. I mean, I grew up working on cars and exposed to gasoline, a lot of solvents too. And, you know, what are the consequences of that as we age and get older? And we're not thinking about it when we were in the 50s and the 60s, you know, sort of charging ahead there, thinking chemicals were our friends and we were solving the world's problems. When in reality, we're really doing a lot of damage to ourselves and our future generations.
Yeah.
Lead's a classic example of that, which, you know, we spread lead all over the environment, putting lead in gasoline and lead in paint, which, you know, and lead's one of the endocrine disruptors, as well as having a lot of other effects. And we just were not taking a precautionary approach to this. They banned lead-based paint in Europe in the 20s. In the United States, not until 78. We did not learn the lessons that we should have learned from looking at the health effects of chemicals.
Well, I read something the other day. I send out inspiring quotes every day. You can go to toxicfreetalkradio.com and just sign up for the newsletter and you can choose that. It's called Words of Wisdom. And one of them recently, I'm sure I won't quote it right, but it was something like that we can't go back and change what we've already done, but we can start today and make a new future. We can't change the past, but we can make a new future. And I think that that's excellent advice for toxics. Well, thank you so much for being with us. And I'm sure we'll talk again.
It'd be great, Deborah. Thank you so much for what you do. You're really great getting the word out like this.
Thank you. This is ToxicFreeTalkRadio.com. I'm Deborah Lynn Gadd. Be well.